very special donors who in their lifetimes have included the New York Society Library in their estate plans by stating an intention to make a bequest to the library. We are exceedingly grateful to all of you, and if anybody is interested in membership in the Good Tree Society, please feel free to talk to me or to Jones Met, our head of development. But thank you to all of you for being here tonight. In Terry McDonald's latest book, The Accidental Life, he writes, "My life seemed normal, except it was different every day." The head of the New York Times review of the book was, "In The Accidental Life, golfing on LSD is just part of an editor's job." The Times goes on to write that The Accidental Life is intelligent, entertaining, and chivalrous. I absolutely love this book. I'm not a writer, but as most of you know, I work with writers every single day here at the library, and I'm fascinated by the writing life. And I really, really enjoyed this book. But you don't have to take my word for it. There were, the reviews were stellar, and they're filled with words and phrases like, "A movable feast for the second half of the 20th century. Inspiring, intoxicating, and just a little dangerous. A glorious book, an affectionate and knowing tour of contemporary literature and journalism, full of essential insight into editing, writing, and living on one's own terms." We're so honored to have Terry McDonald speak with us tonight. Mr. McDonald is an award-winning editor who has been inducted into the American Society of Magazine Editors Hall of Fame. He's been a top editor at Outside, Rolling Stone, Sports Illustrated, and Esquire, among many other magazines. He's also a novelist and a poet and producer for film and television. He's currently president of the board of the Paris Review Foundation and serves on the board of overseers of the Columbia Journalism Review. So please give a warm welcome to Terry McDonald.
The intelligence of it, my heart soars. So I want to tell you about my book. It's about writers and their work and working with them, and editors' notes on writers and writing, in some sense. But the truth is, out of a kind of vanity, I wanted to show myself as a writer. So I thought about that and determined that the best way to do that would be to write about great writers that I had edited and what I had learned from them. And I don't mean just about writing, I mean about the writing life that Carolyn referred to. How, for example, Jim Salter would never talk to you about being a fighter pilot, but that he loved to play touch football, and he would keep meticulous records of meaningless pickup games that we played, which made the games more fun. And how things like how he and Peter Matheson would, on the 1st of November every year, go into the surf off the beach at Sagaponic and emerge to have nice martinis on the beach with their wives. Times like how Jim Harrison once called me up and told me, "You've lynched my baby," over an editing move I made, semicolon. But mostly we talked about food. And how working with P.J. O'Rourke was like working with anthropological field notes. Richard Price would riff like Lenny Bruce when he was pitching TV or we were pitching things together, movies. But it was all practice for his novel, honing his language. What I'm saying is there was always more than the writing, always more. Tom McGuane called this having a long reach, which in his case meant being nominated for a National Book Award in Fiction the same year he won the team roping at the Little Rodeo in Darden, Montana. There are some interstitial chapters in the book, too. I wanted to write a little bit about the tricks that editors use, because writing is about a ideas. Editing is about ideas, but it's also mechanical. You have to get under the hood, so to speak. And whatever you're doing, making magazines, websites, even swimsuit issues, like I did, you pick this stuff up, but I'd never read about it. So I tried to write about it. What I'm talking about are things like how if you could get good at rewriting headlines on a deadline, you felt like one of those Looney Tunes characters who shows up with a stick of dynamite from behind their back. It would change the complexion of the clothes or the newsroom or whatever. One tool that I used often and that I used in the book was to leave the word counts. How many words were there in each at the top of each chapter? I did this when I was an editor because I always wanted to know how much I was about to read. How far my pencil would have to travel. It helped me evaluate pacing, or lack of pacing. And I have been told, or I know now, that the people who have read the book seem to like the book for their own reasons, but they very much point to that word count. So with that in mind, I will tell you that I'm going to speak for probably another 29 minutes. But back to the writers, especially the ones I edited, this way, who knew about it. They were all a little spooked once they found out what I was doing. This was because they were all very attuned to length, even if they weren't being paid by the word. I think that, at all the magazines that I worked, there were 13 of them, feature stories were assigned at a specific length, usually standard 4,000 words. And most writers would take that well over 5,000 and say that they had hit 4, or go under 3 and say that they had hit 4. It was very mysterious to me why being direct about the number of words they were filing was so very difficult for them. I decided finally that it had a lot more to do with alchemy than any lack of discipline. Of course, that reminds me that this was before before Microsoft Word, and stopping to count how many words you had written was refreshing in a way, like having a cigarette or making some tea or taking a break. Now doing a word count has kind of a slot machine kick to it. If you have the discipline, to not to do it every time that you hit save. But this is for me now, just so you know. This is not my problem because I work in Google Docs. That's it. And none of this matters anyway if the piece is good. That's determined by voice and narrative, never length. Going along is always more ambitious and usually more fun. And this was true of lengthy pieces long before they were referred to as creative nonfiction or narrative journalism. And long, too, before we finally debunked the simple-minded web assumption that no one would screen read anything longer than the newscast. We all read much longer on screens, at least I do. And no writer that I ever worked with said they wanted to go short. Neither do I. But I also know that the best pieces seem to find their own length, and that's the alchemy. So I wrote a good bit more about that in different ways from different angles in the book. And I wrote about money and writing for money and what's happened to the media business from the crest of the new journalism, which is about when I entered, to the recent digital innovations, disruptions. Like, my favorite is a class at the Media Lab at MIT where journalism is taught as an engineering problem. Great class. I'm not serious. Anyway, that timeline is the arc of my career, and so too it became the arc of the book, all the way up through when I was not really an editor anymore in any traditional sense, but I was leading digital development at Time Warner Planning. But at its heart, the book is really about writers. Writers who became my friends, some of them now dead, so it's about that too. I'm speaking here of Matheson and Salter and Harrison and David Carr, perhaps most especially about Hunter Thompson and George Plimpton, who shared an unlikely but truly indelible friendship over the course of time that I was editing the two of them. So in the beginning with these two, I thought that what I needed in order to be able to edit them creatively was to be as interesting to them as they were to me, as if. But that was how Hunter and George both worked, with the Hells Angels or Circus Midgets or the Detroit Lions or whoever they were going to write about. George invited them all to his wonderful parties, and Hunter wrote careful, hilarious letters to the people that he wanted to write about, the big ones, like Clinton and Muhammad Ali. It was all obvious how that worked. But I also found that paying Hunter more money made me more interesting to him. With George, though, it was about being a good audience. I remember it was dusk. We were in New Mexico, and we were walking around along a ranch road in New Mexico. And according to George, we were birding. We were on the track of the elusive burrowing owl that lives in the prairie dog holes. But we were doing it in that deeply civilized way that George was so good at. It allowed you to bring your glass of wine or your whatever happened to your drink on your expedition. In George's case, it was always to bring a little water. We had seen no burrowing owls. George had pointed out the back. And he set his drink on the ground, pulled a white t-shirt off over his head, flung it in the air, and looked at George. Tatarita brasiliensis mexicana, he explained. This shirt peaks like 25 feet. Drawing immediately at least a half dozen bats to attack it as it flutters to the ground. They're squeaking their little bat squeaks and their little dive bomber postures. The second throat doubles the number of bats, and so on, until the light is gone and the bats are off on their own business. The trick George explained when he's pulling his t-shirt back on was you had to convince the bats that fluttering up at them on their sonar with some kind of food, like a gargantuan moth, he said, taking a sip of his doers. Now, it was predictable of George to pull something like bat expertise out of nowhere, because when you thought about it, it really wasn't out of nowhere. It never was with George. When he was 14, he spent the summer hunting bats in California's Sierra Nevada, donating the bat specimen skins to museums. It was the kind of summer job that you had if you were George Clinton. Listening to stories about teenage bat hunting was like, I don't know, listening to, you know, thinking about the adventures of a young prince on the frontier. But it was never the privilege that struck you. It was the curiosity. And that was, I think, the solidarity of our friendship. And I recognized that. Because George's questions were like trampolines. This is a technology he greatly admired, by the way. What I mean by that is they bounced you higher and higher to the next question. And this was particularly true when he was talking about writers and writing. Did you know that the great Camus played goal for the Orange Football Club? He asked me one late afternoon. We were walking by an Algerian restaurant near his house on 72nd Street. I was unaware. George sighed. Tony Stewart in Bon Volonté was never moved to write about it. Alas, he said. Imagine. The existential goalkeeper. Alas, I'm sure he gave me a sad end. But to be or not to be was never the question for George. What to do next was his question, although sort of existential imaginings were at the very heart of all the pieces that we worked on together. He would develop ideas, what would it be like to, and then find a way to put himself into the action. I asked if he had considered becoming a soccer goalie, and he had, of course, but he had already written about guarding a hockey net for the Boston Bruins. So, I thought, something came over me, and I blurted out this question. I said, so are you going to write that memoir? I asked. I was clearly baiting him a little. I knew that several publishers were very interested and that he had been offered close to $1 million already for the memoir. George said, I don't want to write about my life. That's what you do now, I said. Well, shouldn't that be enough, he said. Well, the memoir came up a lot. People were always asking when he was going to write it, write one, tell stories about his own life in that way. And thinking about this darker thing, he said it smacked with vanity, and if he wound up having to do it, so be it, for the money, whatever, but not yet. Allure, I think all of you in this room know, because many of you I know knew George, for the publishers was that George knew everybody. Any list of his friends would be incomplete. Sinatra, neighbor, late night drinking program. Hugh Hefner, F, had offered George the editorship of Playboy many times. George's brother said that he dated Jacqueline Kennedy. Warren Beatty would call the office of the Paris Review and whisper, is this the man who's never eaten an olive? George would shout, Warren, is that you? And they would hang up. It was an inside joke. I never got to the bottom of it. But my point is, in the end, it didn't matter who you were, because if you were with George or just at the same party, his manners pulled you in, making you feel comfortable and in on at least some of the secrets. And he had a way, it's very subtle, he had a way of bowing his head when he shook hands that was, like I say, very subtle, but extremely flattering if you were shaking hands. And this happened all the time, because George was meeting so many people all the time. The only problem was that he could never remember names, especially men's names. So it didn't matter. He'd be in the situation, he'd be at a party at his house. He crowded in there, coming across the room toward him would be someone he knew that he knew, but whose name he did not know. And here comes this person in Georgia and say, there's the great man. And the unnamed guest would be. It was just like a terrific greeting to have. And I once was with George, and he greeted the guy, kid delivering pizza, with him. There's a great man. Well, anyway, we went out a lot. Went to book parties and sports events at the Garden, where all the floor guys knew him and were tying one of the open doors for us. Went to dinner, or he ate macaroni and cheese, and it was up to him. And there were the parties at his house, of course. This was in the 80s and 90s, and now the celebrities weren't as bright as they had been in the 60s and 70s, but these parties were still crowded with good-looking, accomplished people. I thought, at least the kids that working at the Paris Review office downstairs were good-looking, especially the young women who, unbeknownst to George, we're having a running contest to get his attention by seeing who could wear the shortest skirt. But George was not so focused on that. He was always looking for expeditions. Like his scheme Christmas 98 that we would go green hunting elephants with his friend Ian Douglas Hamilton. This was to be an old-fashioned hunt, except we were going to do with tranquilizers, tag the elephants for research. And of course, Hunter Thompson would come too. And we would all celebrate New Year's Eve in Lamu. Good plan. But we never made that, like many that we planned. But we did make other trips involving Hunter. who, as I said earlier, shared this perhaps unlikely, but as I got to know them, kind of almost transparent friendship, because I think that they both were feeling more and more trapped by the personas that they had created for themselves. So they were prisoners somehow, this persona. And because of this, I think they recognized each other right off, even if they were very different. Although they did not agree on what had happened when they first met, except that it was on a Lufthansa flight from Frankfurt to Zaire to cover the Elie Foreman fight, the so-called Rumble in the Jungle, in 1974. They were seatmates. Hunter was going to the fight for Rolling Stone. George was going for Sports Illustrated. George remembered that Hunter was very worried about not getting paid for a lecture at Duke, where he had run him up on wild turkey. And Hunter said that he and George compared technical boxing notes like the professionals they were. George remembered that Hunter talking about secret weapons, some kind of torpedoes that were being constructed by revolutionaries in the Congo to disrupt the fight, sending torpedoes down the river. Hunter remembered that George had been treated like a prince of the realm by promoter Don King when they had landed in Kinshasa. George remembered, too, that while he embarked on a week of serious reporting, Hunter smoked hash in the hotel pool and wound up missing the fight. What I remember is that Muhammad Ali was very interested in both of them. They had access to lesson. Back in the States, they talked about each other as if they were the oldest of friends, which was easy because they actually did have a lot in common, too. For example, their career establishing books, Paper Lion and Hell's Angels, were published within a couple months of each other, 66, 67, both praised for immersive reporting and original voice. And there was the music. Hunter loved what he called, I'm going to quote him here, the wild power of the language and the purity of the madness that governs it and makes it music. George would nod. George always played the piano on his short breaks when he was writing. They both liked that about each other. And they were the same height. They were both close to 6'4". They loved drinking, women, sports, and they were evenly matched. More or less. George was a better athlete. Hunter was stronger. They were both competitive. At that point, in 1989, George and I decided to visit Hunter after he had sent me a photograph of himself sinking a 30-foot putt at the Aspen Golf Club. There was a message on the back of this photograph. It said, come out here and play golf with me sometime. And a big plus. Bring George. Plus, bring money. Then I will beat you both like mules. An expedition for George. I had visited Owl Farm before, and I warned George that there would be distractions. But we were both relatively optimistic about our connected missions. My plan was to get Hunter to write a piece for the premier issue of a magazine I was starting called Smart. George wanted to initiate the Art of Journalism series with an interview of Hunter, like it's the Art of Fiction. That was our plan. Fine, Hunter said when we arrived, but first, golf. Now, this was in the review in the Times. It was acid golf. And I'm going to just read a little bit here because it's clearer. We played that first evening in the dying light at the Municipal Aspen Golf Club, which was closed. Hunter just waved to a guy in the pro shop and he brought us a bucket of balls. Hunter had a 12-gauge shotgun in his golf bag, and we had Heinekens in a cooler on the cart, also a fifth of Chevis, a fifth of Jose Cuervo, limes, a fifth of Dewars for George, and an extra cooler of ice. Then here, said Hunter, I did the same thing. When George said he wanted to concentrate on the golf, Hunter licked the third tab and said, oh, that's the batch. I make a point here. George would try anything, but this is telling in a sense because George was so serious about this interview, he was just focused on it and he was working. Hunter could say later that he was working too, but that, we can talk about that in a different way. But anyway, following Hunter's lead, we used the first tee as a driving range to warm up. Hunter's swing was explosive, but not smooth, and his third drive was solid and long. George had a very fluid swing, and he drove each ball progressively further. I never played, but was not pathetic. Hunter accused me of sandbagging and said it was time to get serious. Anyway, the gambling, he rode in the cart to his favorite hole, the 14th. Short, par 3, straight shot over a large pond. The Aspen course, by the way, is a certified Audubon sanctuary, and the pond was full of geese. Got in geese, Hunter said. Granted a Canadiensis, said George. I said, Hunter, you'd like George's bat trick. No bats, said Hunter. We're gambling. Alas, said George, made himself a doer some water. Now each of us would hit 5 balls in a row off the tee and then proceed to the green to putt. Only our best ball would count. We were all in, according to Hunter, for $1,000. So, George put all 5 of his balls on the green. 3 close to us were easily makeable birdies, I thought. Hunter put 3 in the water, 2 on the green. I got none on, didn't care. When we got to the green, George made 2 birdies, and Hunter had 1 ball left to tie. If he could sink a 30-foot putt, like the one he was celebrating in that photo he had sent to us. He walked back and forth between the ball and the hole several times. I was on the other side of the cup holding the flag. It was dark now, really dark the way it was dark in Aspen in the summertime, that sort of glow. But I still couldn't really see his ball that clearly. George was over by the cart, making it doer some water. The ice tinkled. Silence! Hunter shouted. I know your tricks. Oh, that made me laugh. Hunter took another 3 or 4 minutes lining up the putt, struck it quickly, missed by about a foot, charged after it, let out a howl, threw his putter in the direction of the pond, raced back to the golf cart, took the shotgun out, fired it over the pond. The geese lifted off. This beautiful, sparkling crowd, gray and white feathers in the sky. And it occurred to me as I was watching this glitter blend into heaven that having a story to tell about acid golf with Hunter and George was probably good for my career. But I don't know, I'm looking around, I'm still not so sure. We got to the interview the next afternoon and it went on through the night, finally with George asking about writing under the influence of booze or drugs, noting that every writer that he had ever interviewed about this subject had said, no, they could not do it. They lie. This how Hunter began his answer, which ended with, who the hell do you think wrote the Book of Revelations? A bunch of stone sober clerics? So when we were leaving the next day, Hunter took me aside and said, you know, we have to get George better drugs. But in the end, it was a great, great interview. And when it was about to come out, George sent Hunter an advance copy prepared for you. And Hunter sent back a page from the Bible, Revelations, with a big black spot on it. Just like the page Long John Silver sent to Billy Bones in Treasure Island to pronounce him guilty of stealing Captain Flint's treasure from the rest of the pirates. So, my problem that year with it launching smart with less than $200,000, depended not just on the new desktop technology that I was using, but also on convincing writers, important writers, to work for shares in the magazine. By that I mean more or less for free. Their names were the only real collateral I had for raising money, and everyone I asked signed on, starting with George. Hunter loved the idea of having stock slightly less than he hated the idea of working for free. But he eventually agreed after George made a special point to explain to him that it was a sound investment. I think the conversation they would have about that. And Hunter agreed to write a column that he wanted to call The Year of the Wolf for the magazine, but no copy was forthcoming. I complained. George advised patience and encouragement. When I lost Smart Magazine to Japanese investors and I went to Esquire, The Year of the Wolf came with me. But still, plagued by deadline misunderstandings, and he called often in the middle of the night promising a draft instead of a secret novel that he was working on. Polo Is My Life, it was called. And he said it had grown out of the piece on the Pulitzer trial in Palm Beach. And this was the assignment I had used to lure him back to Rolling Snow, which is another chapter of the book that I will take a look at. But in any case, George still advised patience and encouragement, rolled his eyes a little bit. This Polo Is My Life. Months passed. As if it seemed to me, by almost sympathetic magic, almost the day that I decided to scrap The Year of the Wolf, Polo Is My Life arrived at Esquire. But it was not the manuscript of the secret novel. Packed in a huge crate, tight with bubble wrap, was a 8 by 5 foot sheet of plywood. It was hung with crossed polo mallets, live 50 caliber machine gun bullets, and Hunter had titled the collage in red spray paint, Polo Is My Life, and then packed it with his personal totems. Photos, press cards, bar napkins, x-rays, notes, quotes that he liked, lipstick, a joint or two, court records, his court records. So that all of the plywood was covered. It took 3 UPS guys to carry it into my office. So what did I do? I naturally mounted it in the conference room, where it hung as a major attraction until I left the magazine. And writers used to come and look at it, and they came up with a meaning for it that I go along with. It was Hunter's verdict of guilt on all editors, just like the black spot had been for George. Some sort of betrayal, but playful betrayal. George said at that point that he had never seen a writer put so much effort into not writing. So I puzzled over this. Hunter had once told George that if he were rich, which is a relative term for them, he'd wander around like King Farouk, telling editors he was going to write something for them and then not doing it. George just shrugged and said, "I agree that writing was hard." But of course, they both loved writing for that very reason, because it was hard and because they were good at it. Hunter would always say that he taught himself to write, and that he did this as a young man by reading The Great Gatsby aloud as he typed the entire novel. His son, Juan, middle name is Fitzgerald, Juan Fitzgerald Thompson. Hunter's own middle name was Stockton. That's what the S stands for. And he would never explain why, only that his father, who had been born in the last century, was from a place called Horse Cave, Kentucky. A place named full of deep spookiness for Hunter. George's middle name, Ames, was from his great-grandfather, Adelbert Ames, a Civil War hero known as the Boy General. And George had met the Boy General when he was 6, and had thus, as he would say, looked into the eyes of a man who had faced Pickett's charge. Imagine what he saw. And this was a story that George told often. He liked to talk about his especially about this boy general. Well, George said, he was very severe and I was afraid. We were in the garden of his house and he picked up a twig and snapped it in half and said, life ends just like that, boy. Snap. I love that. Over this time, while Hunter was making a name for himself at Rolling Stone with all of the fear and loathing that he wrote about, the two most important magazines for George were the Paris Review and Sports Illustrated, which he began writing for in 1956, only 3 years after he began editing the Paris Review, which, as you all know, is the quarterly done with Peter Matheson and other friends, and it was a hot startup before anyone used that term, and much has been written about all the good times in Paris and the careers that came later. But the big question for George, about George, among his friends, was why he spent so much time on the Paris Review instead of on his own writing. Some of his oldest friends from the Review, Matheson, Bill Skyron, Terry Southern, great writers all, were even a little bit arrogant about it. Why wasn't George tormenting himself with the ambition to write important books like they were? Whenever this came up, George would get mad. I remember we talked about this a couple times. One time, though, when we were working on a piece for Smart about what it was like to mouth catch a grape dropped from the top of Trump Tower. So something about the seriousness we were applying to something so silly made George even madder. Because for George, the Paris Review became a spiritual hideout for 50 years. And it paid nothing, of course. So George had decided to make his way as a journalist until he settled on what more serious work might be. And in the meantime, he'd write about sports and have a good time. And there are some other stories in the book about the early days of George's participatory journalism. My favorite is like the first time out when he's pitching to Major League All-Stars at Yankee Stadium when the public address announcer bungles his name, calling him George Proofrock. It's an irony not lost on George, who's an amateur Eliot scholar, of course, and had lived for a time in the same room where the great poet had been when he was at Harvard. And George did not write about this ever, as far as I know, but he used it in his storytelling all the time. It's a great effect, I thought. He would say, you could go to a quote from Harry Paul and you would say, well, my arm was rather like a ragged claw, and they would look out and see who got the joke. When the expanded SI story became George's first bestseller, which was out of my league, Ernest Hemingway wired George from the Mayo Clinic, where he was being treated for depression, that it was, I'm going to quote Ernest here, beautifully observed, incredibly conceived, with the chilling quality of a true nightmare, the dark side of the moon of Walter Mitty. Huh. It was a gift from Hemingway, intended as a marketing word, and Hemingway's Walter Mitty analogy, I've decided, has a surface truth. But it overlooks the obvious difference that in Mitty's daydreams, he always succeeded. While George's real-life adventures, he always failed. The truth is, I think, that George's work had more to do with every man than Mitty. And this was always obscured by his careful, self-depreciating prose, which made him so easy and hilarious to read. Plus, Walter Mitty was a wimp. George was not a wimp. Above his desk, his apartment, 72nd Street, George had a photograph of Hemingway walking the country road. You probably all remember this picture. In Ketchum in Winter, he's kicking a can high over his head. And this was just days before he killed himself in 1961. In my office, I had a photo of George wrestling the gun from Sirhan Sirhan's hand the moment after he had shot George's friend Bobby Kennedy in Los Angeles in 1968. It's not going to be. I was in George's office a lot, often, although he was never, ever in mine, not Rolling Stone, not Esquire, not Sports Illustrated, or anywhere else. And this has nothing to do with the idea that you never go to another man's office, the arrogance of that. George was just too busy. Counter to his reputation for never missing a party, I found that he guarded his calendar and spent most days when he was not on the road, under that picture, writing and editing the Paris Review. And he was hard about it, like he was about a lot of things. His writing, of course, but also the work of what he called tin-eared editors who edited him. So you see, George could be irascible as both writer and editor. He was a tough editor on either side of the desk. But what I came to think, as the point of the book, is that he loved editing most of all. Excuse me. Because of the puzzles in it. And that's what drew me to it, and that explains part of what we were like together, I think. George closed the 50th anniversary issue of the Paris Review 2 days before he died, and we spoke that afternoon about how he might contribute to Sports Illustrated's upcoming 50th anniversary issue. As always, he had many, many ideas. He took me to dinner that night at the Brook Club, where we sat at that long communal table, and with the other members. George loved the Brook Club. He'd been going there for a long time, and it was a place where he was known, and his celebrity never bested him. And he was more aware of that as he got older. But Peter Matheson, not long before, had mentioned to me that sometimes, if George thought he was unobserved, he would let his face go slack, blank even, open jaw a little bit. And it made him look, if not like a dead man, at least someone very sad, or someone fighting something dark. Peter said it made him sad when he saw George that way, but I had never seen it until that night when we were leaving, until that night. And then when we were leaving the Brook, he told me that he had recently committed to a $750,000 contract to write that memoir. And he died the next night. A few days later, Sarah, his wife, was searching his computer and came across a notes and obligations file. The last entry was written at 1:25 a.m., September 25th, the morning he died in his sleep. George often returned home from late dinners and sat typing into the night until he was tired enough to turn in. And this particular memo was a run of reminders, ideas for future issues of the Paris Review, drafts of letters, some anecdotes for the memoir he was determined never to write. And that last morning, George finished his notes with a poem by Emily Dickinson, which was Fame as a Bee. It has a song, it has a sting, it has a wing. And then, the very last entry was a quote from André Gide. The quote is, the drawback to a journey that has been too well planned is that it does not leave enough room for adventure. George was 76. Now, Hunter said that he never expected to live to be 50, which was no consolation to any one of us when he killed himself at the age of 67. Year and a half after George passed. When I thought about Hunter's last moments, and I wondered about what his final plan was, what he was thinking, the secret that he was keeping as he loaded that 45, and I thought about the adventures of working with him and George. When they were alive, I was always surprised by how many people felt possessive about their friendships. George and Hunter. When they were both gone, I wondered about my own. I never told anyone, certainly neither of them, but in some kind of magical thinking, for a while there, I thought of them as my best friends. Truer of my relationship with George, in spite of our age difference, Hunter was more like a crazy, dangerous cousin. Uncle, maybe. I was always aware of the gift George had to make people feel like they were great friends, even though they were not very close at all. And Hunter had that too. anyone he ever met at ease when he felt like it. And this happened more often than his reputation suggests, and I always found him to be very kind. Although his friendships could be situational or transactional even, he was sentimental about them. He one Christmas he sent me an expensive pocket knife with the Long Hunt engraved on the blade. So now, George's bats in New Mexico and Hunter's midnight calls come back to me in shock flashes at almost. And I think everyone who knew them has similar experiences. When suddenly remembering something that one of them did or said illuminates them again, perhaps in a new way. Every place I worked, George wrote at least one piece for me. I think Johnny Depp has Polo is My Life Now, along with the rest of Hunter's papers. And it was an extraordinary piece. But then it was just another part working with Hunter. Like Mouth Catching Grapes was work with George. And it was like that all the time. Outrageous when I think about it now. And maybe it didn't always make sense that the best work we did had to have a joke at the bottom of it. You know, not ha-ha, but hilarious, like that black spot Hunter said to George. And then I remember that Treasure Island is a simple book with a very clear plot. Adventurous boy kidnapped by pirates joins pirates. Cowboy, hippie, weird. And that's why we made t-shirts. But that was a digression. I think that the journalism in Europe, it was more focused. And the news magazines were very much like ours. There's people that said all of those match, which everybody says, oh, we'll do something a little like Paris Match. I always suspected that the people who were saying that never really looked at Paris Match. It was very sloppy, I thought. But there were no sort of general idea rolling magazines, or there weren't as many, so it was not as much fun there. There were some good ones. Of course, I don't read French. Yes.
I think all the writers you mentioned working with were men. Did you have much experience working with women, and did you find it was a different kind of experience bringing out the best in them?
That's a great question. I write a good bit about that in the book. I had my favorite writer is Joan Didion, and I could tell you that I pursued her, and And I can also tell you that she has impeccable manners, but is no fan of ass kissing. I've worked with her husband, John. But anyway, my point was, I did work with some women. But I ran men's magazines. And this was the period when there was that great change. The women's movement was really rising up, and we were all conscious that we tried to write about it. We didn't take our daughters to work at Esquire. Warrior College, it's a great, best day of my life, almost. But the way it worked for women at the beginning was that they ran almost all the magazines, but they were kept from the top of the masthead. It was an unfairness that was really haunting, I think, to anybody who saw it clearly. What would happen all the time would be someone would say, "Wow, you know, she's great. She's a great number two." But if they had said that about a man, it would have been a career-busting, horrible, damaging thing to say. And that lack of sensitivity permeated, especially the big publishing companies. Time Inc., where I worked there, was still a problem. But I don't have. As for editing a woman or a man, I can't think of anything except perhaps that they were better at their word counts.
Huh.
Thank you very much.